that song I played for you a moment ago that I kind of just let go, I'm going to pull from that. I'm going to flip some lyrics around. So the lyrics originally were, help me become what you need, meet me in the middle or somewhere in between. And so here I now have, we'll see if we can make this work. Meet me in the middle or somewhere in between. Help me become what you need. And I thought, oh, that's way more original than what I started with. But if it wasn't for me being willing to write mm-hmm. out this thing that felt, I don't know, not the perfect representation of me as an artist, if I wasn't able to do that, I wouldn't have something that I'm now really excited to like continue to write as soon as we get off this.
Welcome to Orchestrated, a Musio podcast where we discuss the past, present, and future of music creation to explore exactly what it means to be a musician in the modern era. I'm Chris Hazel, and this week we are diving into the world of songwriting. For some of us, songwriting may have been a natural evolution in our music journeys, but for the rest of us, the prospect of writing a song might actually seem kind of like a daunting task. So this week, Mike, Patty, and I are joined by the accomplished musician, producer, and songwriter Scott Goldbaum. In addition to performing with massive artists like Sting, Keith Urban, Lauv, Charlotte Lawrence, and more, Scott is also one of the best and most prolific songwriters I've ever met. It seemed like a no-brainer to have him on the pod to help us unravel the ball of yarn that is songwriting. In the episode, Scott shares his thoughts on how to approach songwriting, the importance of self-elucidation and non-judgment in the creative process, and he even shares in real time some great exercises to help you get out of your own way, creatively speaking. So if songwriting is something that you're curious about, keen to try, or even just interested in as a subject, I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation. Let's dive headfirst into the world of songwriting with Scott Goldbaum. Thanks for coming on. I mean, I'm super excited to have you here, because the subject matter is one that is near and dear to our hearts.
And what is that subject matter?
The subject matter is songwriting.
Okay, great. Yeah, that sounds really fun. Are we doing this now? Is this happening in real time?
Yeah.
Are we still okay?
We're recording. I'll do a whole intro separately. Don't worry about it.
But cool.
You and I have known each other for a long time. We met in like our late teens, early 20s.
Yeah.
Our bands were kind of like buddy bands in like the LA Valley. But since then, you've gone on to work with some like pretty amazing acts. Like you've gone on to play with Sting, yeah. Keith Urban, Lauv. And that is pretty incredible in its own right. But the thing that I've always admired most about you, or one of the things that I've always admired most about you, is your songwriting.
Thanks, man.
You've always had this really great way of exploring these complex themes and complex melodies and melding them together in like a beautiful song that's still approachable and not too heady and not too crazy. And one of the things that I've always found is that, you know, songwriting can be this sort of nebulous thing for people, especially if they're just starting out in music. They don't really know where to start with it. It can be this thing that's a little bit mysterious. So I thought maybe we could have a conversation about songwriting to sort of help demystify that process for people.
And it's mostly for me. I mean, that's a mystery to me. As an instrumental composer for film, TV, and games, I have never written a song before. So I'm...
Oh, wow.
Hopefully I'll learn something today.
But yeah, I mean, just to get started, how did you first get into music? And then like, how did you discover your love of songwriting?
I was a jock in middle school and up to that point, and I broke my nose really badly in a basketball game right before I was supposed to go on this youth group church winter retreat. And I was really bummed that I couldn't go, especially because I had a big crush on like the pastor's daughter and all my friends were going. It was one of those coming of age trips for sure, where you leave the house and you feel like you're really on your own for 4 days or 5 days. Mm-hmm. But the doctor who reset my nose was like, you cannot go to this winter camp retreat where you're going to be throwing snowballs at each other. So I was really disappointed. And when one of the counselors found out that I wasn't able to go, he said, Scotty, don't you have one of those like Costco, like Yamaha guitars? Just bring it. And each day while everybody else is outside throwing snowballs, I'll teach you how to play guitar. And so for 4 days, my first guitar teacher, Matt Price, just locked me in a cabin and we learned how to play guitar. And situated into that sort of cookie cutter framework of contemporary worship songs, there was no better application for the things that I was learning in like sixth grade, seventh grade. Because, you know, it was like a week later, once we got home, I was then in the youth group band. I was like the third guitarist where, I was able to take the few things I learned about guitar and apply them in a real setting where people are singing back at us, where it's very inconsequential for me because I'm really low. I'm a third guitarist. I didn't need to be up there. But I was also learning about the framework of general songwriting, you know, like an arrangement of verse, chorus, bridge, chorus, out, right? Mm-hmm. And so having so many of those opportunities on a regular basis, I decided that guitar was going to become a vehicle for songwriting for me before it was anything else. I really felt it benefited my nervous system. It made me feel like I was stepping into my own individuality. It was extremely collaborative. So coming from a world of team sports and then moving into a world of being able to collaborate with people on a non-competitive level felt really, really exciting to me. As a kid, I remember thinking I didn't care about whether it was football, baseball, basketball. I didn't care about my team winning or losing. I only cared about not losing it for the team.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a space like this as a kid, you know, just trying to remember it 30 years later, however long ago it was, it was great. I came to really love it. And when I started playing guitar and songwriting, I was writing silly songs. My best friend at the time was Spencer Sharp. And his older brother, Aaron Sharp, was in a band that has since blown up too. They've got a big single called My Type. In fact, forgive me. Saint Motel, of course. So Saint Motel, a massive band. I think they're signed to like Elektra, but he was another one of my guitar teachers along the way, Aaron Sharp. And they had a dog named Duchess. And like we all do with each one of our pets, we tend to assign our pets like 40 names. And so in addition to calling them Duchess, eventually they called that dog Skeeter. And the way that it got to Skeeter was that they had a rat named Skeeter. Mm-hmm. Duchess ate the rat, so they called her Skeeter Eater. And then eventually it just got abbreviated to Skeeter. And they wrote a song about Skeeter, and the lyrics were just like funny chords. And instead of words, they were just sounds, like imitating the way they speak to the dog. And it was such an escape for me. I was like, all I want to do is write funny songs. And so for a long time, it was just writing silly songs. And then it was like a complete 180, you know, as you move into high school and you start taking yourself way too seriously. And that kind of is where you and I merge, where we're talking about, you know, more complex feelings and everything is so melodramatic. So that's kind of what brought me into songwriting and into being in bands, my whole adolescence. It was because of being in a fairly well-regarded band in LA. I think this is where we met, The Harm, that we had a fan and her boyfriend, the two of them came to a lot of our shows. When the band broke up and I was doing a bunch of solo stuff, you know, leaning into acoustic guitar, John Butler style, Andy McKee style, you know, finger style stuff, I had posted a video of one of my original tunes called Forest Home.
Yep.
And the boyfriend to this girl, he had kept tabs on my solo project after my band The Harm broke up. He ended up working as the social media manager for Randy Jackson from American Idol. And so he showed this clip of me to Randy, and that kind of just changed the course of my professional life. I started working with Randy Jackson on a how to play guitar series. And then he came out with his own line of guitars, which we slung on the Home Shopping Network for like 5 years.
I remember
but it was
that.
Through Randy, right? I turned it into a drinking game for people at home to watch. and it was through Randy that I got connected with Keith Urban, who wanted to do his own line of educational series, 30 songs in 30 days, and his own line of guitars. He still gives out one of his own personal guitars at every concert he plays. He was a joy to work with. And so I find myself in this like educational niche while I'm still fronting bands in LA. It ended up moving on to working with Fender and their online learning platform, Fender Play. That's been a big undertaking for me since 2017. And then along with that, you know, just the more I open myself up to opportunities as opposed to just fronting a band and going on tour with my own original music, came opportunities to be in support of other artists like Sting and Lauv and early on Charlotte Lawrence, other American Idol winners like Maddie Poppy, Skylar Grey, wearing a lot of different hats, like saying yes to things before I was probably completely qualified. In sure. Sting's band, it was like, you play mandolin, right? It was like, yeah. And I learned how to play mandolin in time. And, the gig went well, so I can say that in real time now. But the same sort of thing, like you play keyboards, can you music direct? Can you do background vocals? And I think a lot of it was there's a fine line there because you don't want to overpromise and underdeliver. But if you're willing to put in the time, as my wife will attest to those 18-hour days of me working on these things that got me the gig, but at the time I may have felt insecure with, it's since made me those things. I had a session last night where I played mandolin for 2 hours and I loved it. I'm probably taking on a gig this year where I'm going out on tour with the Nord again for the first time in a couple years. So it started with songwriting and saying yes to a lot of things as they presented themselves, eventually having to disband those projects that were kind of, spinning their tires in the mud. And then and navigating it with an open mind and keeping my overhead as low as I could along the way.
It's funny how much of that I can relate to. Like, so my songwriting journey also started out with writing funny songs. I think the first song that I ever wrote was with a friend of mine named Alex. I think we were 8 or 9. I was just learning how to play guitar. One of the first songs that I learned how to play on guitar was Time of Your Life by Green Day.
Yeah, it's a rite of passage.
Yeah. And sure. And we took that song and we like changed the lyrics. That was our very first thing, our very first foray into songwriting. And then, as you said, you get older and you start getting a little bit more serious. And then all of these other opportunities start coming in that don't necessarily have to do with the thing that you're doing and pursuing as your own thing. But they're sort of an extension of that. And you expand into those things, and they also in turn sort of inform, as you're learning more in these seemingly disconnected worlds, they start to inform your world as well and your songwriting and all of that kind of stuff.
For real. As you say that, I think I'm realizing in real time how full circle it's come, because I think for me, I've gotten to a point where the people who take themselves too seriously are the people I take the least seriously. Mm-hmm. And I've been that person.
Right.
And so I think these days I'm looking for a lot more lightheartedness in songs as opposed to that desperation that's still like, I've become really good friends with Chris Caraba of Dashboard Confessional.
Oh, really?
Like my emo god. Yeah, he's a student and I still teach and everything. And he's a student and he's a mentor. He's a big brother more than he'll ever realize. Amazing songwriter. But yeah, hearkening back to that era of just spill your heart out, because he's a great songwriter. He has a great balance. But I think a lot of people who are like watered down versions of those pillars in the songwriting community, they're imitating a little too much.
Sure.
And it gets in. I think that's something that both you and I did growing up, Chris. I remember I was imitating so much that I used to sing with a British accent. You know, my mom just listened to that much Oasis and Bush in the car that I couldn't help from adopting that. But then over time you hope that you find your own voice. And, you know, to Mike's point earlier, we can talk about a lot of tips that I put into place for writing that allows you to kind of get out of your own way, stream of consciousness and stuff like that.
Yeah, I definitely want to explore those. That's actually, that specific point is a question that I have on here. But before we even get into that stuff, you're playing in the church band, you're starting to explore songwriting, you're writing these funny songs. What was it like for you as you were starting to write songs? Like as you were starting to take yourself more seriously, did you feel like you were a natural at it? Was it a big learning process? And then do you remember also the first time you ever wrote a song and you sat back and you said, hey, that's actually pretty good?
I don't know. You know, I was so young that ego was so forefront that I was kind of just looking in two places. You know, externally, I'm looking at my friends and my parents for gratification, validation. And I took a lot of that to heart, to the extent where I remember friends would be like, man, you're a great guitarist, great songwriter, but when you sing, it sounds like you have cancer. And I remember as a result of that, as a kid, I heard that in sixth grade, I got a different vocalist nearly immediately, where I was still writing all the words and getting our buddy Andy Frasco to sing in the band, our first band Self-Made. And I bring him up because he's gone on to be a huge success. He's got a show at the Fonda this Friday in LA. But I think for me, you know, there was enough darkness when I was a kid, you know, stuff that I was witnessing, that the melodramatic stuff actually came from a very authentic place. Mm-hmm. And so the second place I was looking was, again, whether I knew it or not at that point, was definitely my nervous system. And so when I would write a song, I would take those things really seriously as a kid. Yeah. And I remember I would like be in bands with like other dudes from the San Fernando Valley, and they'd be like, "Jesus, Scott, like, why are you talking about like life's okay over here on the West Valley? Like, you don't have to bring us down so much." And I remember I really tried. You know, I came from a place of earnestness, but I had to make it a little bit more lighthearted, because sometimes I think when you dig too deep into the darkness, it's like. Just let the darkness be dark. You don't need to shine. You don't need to shine any more darkness on it. So I think for me, it was like the validation was coming from people in my life as a kid, because my ego was all about it. You know, before I knew what an ego was, with the funny songs and the cover songs, you know, singing those Wonderwall and Everlong, mm-hmm. Time of Your Life classics. And then when it came to writing more serious songs, I can remember the names of the songs. In fact, I bet if I picked up a guitar, I could play songs that I wrote when I was like 14, 15 that were kind of deep. You know, I remember that one of the lyrics was like, "Taken by surprise and tossed beneath your will. I can't see inside. I know you can't wait till I'm screaming. You're leaving me behind. Things will change in time." Like all these things, like from my formative years, trying to express and make sense of the things that I was seeing and I was experiencing. And it was an amazing therapeutic outlet. So again, whereas with sports, which is such a huge part of my life, my goal was to just not lose it for people. Mm-hmm. The reason I did songwriting for a long time was to sustain my well-being. As I got older, I realized that songwriting can't, and I think the best songwriting doesn't, tend to come from a place of personal experience and needing to vent or needing to have a therapeutic release. I think it comes from the craft of songwriting, but mm-hmm. I'm glad that route got me into the world of songwriting.
So that's an interesting point. So one of the things that I've always noticed about you is that you're a very prolific songwriter as well. Like, you write a lot. To contrast that, I feel like my songwriting has always been, you know, like few and far between. It's like a moment of inspiration that strikes me when I'm not ready for it. And then if it's not there, it's not there, kind of thing. And I wonder if a lot of that has to do with writing from personal experience versus looking at songwriting as a craft. So like, what are some of the things that you would, I'm trying to think of how to say this. I remember one time you and I went to a cafe and we were having dinner, and I was asking you a similar question, and you put a glass on the table and you said, "Write a song about this glass." This glass of water.
That's so lame. I can't believe I did that.
But that stuck with me.
No, you know, that's sweet. That's sweet. And yeah. I remember I was interviewing Butch Walker for a Fender thing a while ago, and he had a similar take. It's really helpful to get out. It's really helpful to go out on change your exposition, change your setting up. And he was on a subway, and he would see a guy, and he'd see the guy in the corner sitting down with his briefcase, and he'd start asking himself, "Where is he going? Mm-hmm. Where is he coming from? Is he late? What's in that briefcase? Are those shoes something that he's had for a long time, or are those brand new? Is he wearing what he's wearing to impress people?" And he's building a story around that. And I think I can also relate that to Dan Wilson, who's a songwriter. I remember I opened up for him many years ago, and I was able to hear him do these acoustic versions of these songs that he's written that have since been purposed for Adele or Taylor Swift. And he talks a lot about the freedom of writing songs that you're kind of commissioned to write, as mm-hmm. opposed to songs that you feel the responsibility of bearing your life experience. It's your magnum opus. It's a precise personal testimony, because who knows your story better than you do? And so I think having something like a glass that you can put on the table, or a stranger that you can look at in the distance and then just start building a story around is extremely liberating and helps you get away from thinking of everything through the lens of quality and preciousness and more through the lens of quantity. Sure. I think about, you know, the truth of the matter is coming on this, I wasn't sure if we were going to talk about songwriting or touring or teaching or navigate, you know, just being a dude in Los Angeles my whole life and trying to make a living doing something relevant to what I love to do. But in all these different seasons where I've had to emphasize these different hats, it's all kind of gone back into the same river where I've toured with a lot of amazing songwriters. So even when I'm not songwriting, I'm studying theirs. Mm-hmm. I remember going on tour with an artist who's a dear friend of mine named Charlotte Lawrence, and her dad is Bill Lawrence. And Bill has created and has been the showrunner of shows like Scrubs, most recently Ted Lasso, bunch of massive shows.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I learned through him what a showrunner is. I had no idea until a few years ago. My understanding of a showrunner, what he does, is that he's responsible for overseeing the directing, the casting, the editing, mm-hmm. and the writing like 5 days a week. How do you make time when you're so burnt out? You don't have time to be inspired.
Right.
You know, when you're supposed to write, the rewrite of this script or the forthcoming script on a 22 episode season or whatever it might be. And I was just so inspired pulling from a different medium, applying it to our songwriting medium about, you know, letting go of things needing to be so precious and just leaning into the craft of songwriting. And what I think I've learned is that more is merrier. So if you're right, like one thing I really miss, like I've got my cell phone here and I can't tell you how many times I'm in sessions and we have our notes tab up and we're just using our thumb to write lyrics. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that I miss in modern songwriting and a lot of the sessions I've seen is people aren't writing like five verses to keep the best two. They're really just chiseling out one verse and then another verse until they're totally finished. And like, I was up pretty late last night because I had this song. In fact, do you think it's possible? I think I want to demonstrate it with the guitar and the voice for a second, if that's cool.
Yeah, please do.
I was writing this little melody on guitar. We'll see if this mic picks it up. You can hear that all right?
Yep.
And I think like the working melody and lyrical content was like, help me become what you need. Meet me in the middle or somewhere in between. Cute, corny, like sweet. Kind of reminded me of Remember Me from Coco.
Sure,
and right. Then last night, and so I kind of just let it go, but it's in one of my many tabs and voice memos and stuff like that. And the melody was sweet enough that I remembered it, but I've been obsessed with the Rubber Bridge guitar lately. And so I thought as I was writing this thing last night, this will be even more tricky to hear, but let's give it a go. Let's see if I can figure this out. I was writing this cool line and I was like, okay, I've been listening to a new record each day. It's been a fun resolution I've been having. We can talk more about that in a second. But I was listening to like a lot of Jose Gonzalez and it reminded me of that sort of Heartbeats vibe. And I wanted something to fit in there. And I realized, okay, well, that song I played for you a moment ago that I kind of just let go, like it exists, but kind of in a frozen state. I'm going to pull from that. I'm going to flip some lyrics around. So the lyrics originally were, help me become what you need, meet me in the middle or somewhere in between. And so here I now have, we'll see if we can make this work. Meet me in the middle or somewhere in between. Help me become what you need. And I thought, oh, that's way more original than what I started with. But if it wasn't for me being willing to write out this thing that felt stolen and not mine, and not so much disingenuous, but I don't know, not the perfect representation of me as an artist. If I wasn't able to do that, I wouldn't have something that I'm now really excited to like continue to write as soon as we get off this.
Yeah.
So I think more is more in that sense. And I think writing about a glass or a stranger or these little like random sports hydrating supplements I've got here that I should add to my water, I'll do that in real time. You know, why am I taking these? You know, and again, it's just because, again, I think more is more in terms of having things to pull from at a time where we're often creating things out of efficiency. I think it's great when we can take pen to paper, and I tend to write better that way.
Yeah. And on that specific point, I think writing, like if you're writing lyrics, literally pen to paper, like with your hand is a very beneficial thing to do, but I'm going to leave that there. And I'm going to say it's such an important thing from my perspective to be okay with having a half finished idea or even like just a small snippet of something and then putting it away for a long time, like you said, and digging it out. I think a lot of people, you know, think as a songwriter, you sit down, you write a song, and that's what you do. And they might get discouraged if they go and try to write a song and they can't figure out where to go with it. Mm-hmm. But there's such a massive part of the songwriting process that is like, hey, this didn't go anywhere. I love this little piece. Like I have this guitar piece. It's like a verse. I haven't figured out where to go for a chorus. I've had it for 4 years, but I keep revisiting it time and time again. And then I'll come up with a different chorus. And then I'm like, yeah, I liked that for a minute, but then now it's not working. But like sometimes you sit down to write a song and it comes out immediately in one sitting. And then sometimes you have these little pieces like you just demonstrated that you carry around with you for months or even years.
Yeah.
And then as you grow as a person and as you change as a person, the context of that music in your life and in your brain and in your experience changes as well. And you might actually have a different idea for where to take it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a really beautiful way of putting it, that leave space in your writing. Don't feel that urgency that you have to finish it all up at age 32. Mm-hmm. Because at age 35, you know, if there's still 3/4 or 1/4 of the song left to be written, you might want those 3 years of experience to maximize the potential impact of that song.
Yeah.
Yeah. And to be honest, man, you know, I think that writing insulated, like if I'm too in a box, especially because lyrical content's involved, you know, different from a lot of the stuff that Mike's producing and composing on a regular basis, I find it essential. Like from my early years of like whenever I had an idea and I'd show it to my mom, or now my wife, who's 10 times more musically inclined than I am, like having an individual and then expanding that to a tribe of chosen colleagues that you can send your music to along the way for feedback is invaluable. Mm-hmm. It's really invaluable. It kind of breathes a little bit more life into it. So whether I'm writing these like instrumental compositions, I've been doing that a lot lately, you know, putting library stuff together. And I'm surrounded in this little, you know, this is like 100-square-foot studio, and I've just got instruments quite literally just surrounding me. I just spin and grab one. And so I've been writing just like that. I'll grab an instrument and then I'll add a bass, or I'll add a banjo, whatever. I'll play with MIDI, or I'll play with the Prophet, and I'll even grab this thing that I've been obsessed with, this little Kirby, what is it called? Automatone.
Oh yeah.
These are great.
Oh yeah.
Can't get enough of these guys. There it is. Yeah, you can see the appeal. So that goes to say, I still have groups of people. And when I say colleagues, they don't have to be musicians, just groups of people. Because my mom wasn't a musician.
Right.
Just people to share some things with, inconsequentially, and say, hey, here's the thing I'm working on. And still seeing how they respond to it. Because quite often, I'm just too locked in my own head. So I think it's very critical to have people to share these things with. When it comes to songwriting, and it also is really great because we all have our defaults as players, as writers, and whether it's because we don't want to admit to them, mm-hmm. or they just may be blind spots to us. It's really helpful to have another set of eyes be like, oh, even if it's diplomatic, they're like, this really reminds me of what you did on this last song. And then you realize, oh, okay, I'm doing my shtick.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think having a tribe of people that you can inconsequentially send things to, whether they're half baked or fully mastered, is beneficial.
I have a question for you. First of all, this is very interesting. And, you know, songwriting for someone like myself and probably many of the people that follow CineSamples and Musio are primarily orchestral, cinematic composers. And there's probably a small percentage of us that have actually tried to do songwriting. But I had a question for you, which is, as professionals, what we have to do is get really good at our craft so that when we get the chance to write something, we have to be able to perform quickly and write whatever is needed for that situation. Are you ever in a situation like that where it's like, hey, 3 p.m., we need this song and crank it out? And yeah. What do you do? I'm trying to see if there's a parallel with, for us, you know, it's like classical music, music theory nerds, mm-hmm. we get our bag of tricks. We talked about this in a previous podcast. Mm-hmm. You kind of develop that bag of tricks that you can kind of draw from when you're on a deadline. Is there a similar parallel there for being a songwriter who needs to create, because we're talking about craftsmanship, and you need to do it, you know, by a certain time or whatever?
I think the closest parallel that I can come up with would have a lot to do with licensing opportunities. And I'm not so into the world of getting briefs of we want a sound alike or we want a song that fits this bill,
yeah.
this general tempo with a lot of adjectives to describe what they're going for to be in the background of this, you know, Banana Republic commercial or whatever it may be. I haven't really spent much time navigating big licenses where songs are written from ground up for that reason, but I'm sure it exists. You know, I've got plenty of people that can speak to that really well. I have a friend named Jenna Moranga who's goes by Isla June. They're an amazing artist, and they've also kind of pivoted their focus on producing a lot of their content with really quick turnarounds for exactly what you're describing. I think because I've kind of veered in and out of, okay, I'm writing a lot of music all the time, but I'm also so frequently in service to artists. My experience with urgency usually has to do with the sideman world of like, all right, I've got to get up to speed with learning how to play these parts for this gig, go on this tour, learn something for like a late night TV show, get background vocals. You know, in fact, it's not often that my creative production world tends to collide with my live touring world. This year, I might, for the first time, because the reality of it is that I've played my original songs plenty. You know, I've toured and I've done that, but not on the stages, not on the types of theaters and arenas where the artist I'm playing for have. But it looks like this year I'm going to be working with an artist I can't say quite yet, but who I've actually gotten to play a lot on their record and write a lot of parts for. And so that will be a new experience to get to take those things that I've played on the studio and that I feel like I have some ownership in and get to play for, you know, people at the Greek Theater or the Hollywood Bowl or something like that. But yeah, as far as like turnaround, I'm sure there is. It's just, I don't have enough experience in the licensing world too.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of like, yeah, there's times where you need to write something and you're getting yourself out of the way. It's
yeah.
You're in service to something else. Mm-hmm. And for me, this is something I've done probably 98% of the time. And every once in a while, I get to just write something for myself.
Yeah.
And it's very rewarding. But sometimes it's challenging when you don't have the practice of just like, well, who am I?
Yeah.
I'm used to just writing something for this scene or for this trailer or for this television show.
There is a part of it, Mike, where in terms of songwriting, I had this experience when I moved to Nashville. So there's like two parts of this. Balloons. So in Nashville, co-writing is a really big thing. A lot of people do, you know, will get together with a team of writers and you'll get into a room and you'll write a song together. And then someone will go out and pitch that to different artists. that's much more akin to composing, right? Where you have a project that you're working on, and those kinds of things. Yeah. There's also the aspect of writing for another artist, which I've done a couple of times as well. Like, you know, an artist wants an EP, and you're writing and producing this EP for them or something. That's also a little bit more akin to it because there is a little bit of a deadline. There is a little bit of a work aspect to it, but it's also slightly different because a lot of times you're working with that artist. There is still the songwriter process that you're going through of, you know, exploring these different ideas, exploring these, the different melodic content, the different lyrical content, what you want the song to be about. So it is a little work for hire feel, I guess.
Yeah, for real.
Scott, have you had any experiences in that, and what's that been like for you?
And every room's different. The way that a lot of my colleagues tend to work when we're, and I would connect with this approach, when we are working with an artist, where we're in a session and the artist is there, we're writing for them. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the opposite approach of taking that time and asking, how do I feel? And it's more about connecting with the artist and getting to know how they feel, opening them up. A lot of songwriting sessions just start with conversations. And like anything else in this industry, it's relationships, right? So I don't know that you're often going to crack as much of a code with depth unless you have, when you're meeting somebody for the first time, as opposed to having a longstanding relationship with someone and being able to converse about what's going on in their lives and then melding the real with the craft. Mm-hmm. But again, I do think you nailed it on the head that that's probably a better example as opposed to like finishing a brief from your home studio to submit to like a Kohl's campaign or something like that. But working, akin to that would be working with an artist and, you know, you guys have blocked 3, maybe 6 hours, maybe a whole day to do something. But again, you're using muscles not for necessarily self-reflection as much as you are connecting and trying to, especially I'm 36. So I find myself in this like big brother role a lot when I'm in those rooms. Mm-hmm. When you're trying to pull things out of the artists themselves and then help shape that for them and connect with them in ways that are authentic or be like empower them by being like, I have no idea what that experience must be like, but what if we put it through this filter? Artist contrast, you're talking about something really dark. What if we actually made it like, what if we could like put a groove to this sorrow? Like, what if we could actually take something that's really sad and make it sound like a bop? That is when I think being able to pull from the craft is really helpful when you can't connect to something. But also I think the more rich your life is outside of what you do for a living, the more of an ability you'll have to connect with all sorts of people you find yourself in a room with.
The relationship between you and the artist that you're working with and writing for is similar to the relationship between the composer and the director. So you're sitting down when you have a director and you're working on the film, you're trying to understand the message that they're trying to get across and learn about their vision for it and then help support that. Maybe come in with some alternative ideas that might help tell that story through a different lens. Like you said, Scott,
you're there to make them look good. It sounds like,
Your
job is there, to convey their vision. It's almost like you're a chameleon in a way. You're in there.
Yeah, I think so. Right. And that's where the craft comes in. And I think sometimes you get brought in and this is the case, you know, I'm often brought in on things that, cause I'm like the, we all get somewhat labeled, and maybe this is true in the composer world. You know, the stuff I do tends to not be grandiose or like really powerful or like rocking. I tend to do a lot of like sweet, cinematic, layered, pretty, gentle type of productions. And so I can get brought in on a lot of ballads and stuff like that. It's fun to switch gears when you find yourself in a room where people don't really have a label for you yet. So you're always ready to be a chameleon when the opportunity strikes.
Here's a question that I get a lot from people, and I'm curious what your experience is with it. first of all, how do you tend to get an idea for a song? And then once you have an idea, do you like, how do you start it? You know, some songwriters start with, you know, instrumentation. Some songwriters start with lyrics. Like, what is your process from ideation to starting to figure that out?
Giving it a little bit of thought and being really honest with myself. I think lately it's been the music first.
Mm-hmm.
I think the music tends to help me find the affect. And because I'm often recycling material, I'm not just saying I'm sitting down to write a song.
Sure.
It's I'm sitting down to be with this moment of inspiration that for me often comes from a stringed instrument. And I'm going to take that moment into the world of existing creative output, like all these little lyrical ideas that I have. Having said that, if I'm just in the mood to write, period, whether or not I have an instrumental idea, it often is stream of consciousness. It's often free association where I will just write and it'll be nonsensical. Mm-hmm. But then there will be one little moment in there that I really like. Like we can try something in real time where it'll be silly and maybe I'll say something inappropriate because it's just the thoughts, the current of thoughts that are going through my head. But if you want to, we can try it in real time right now.
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah.
Okay. We're really reaching into the dark here, guys. Let's give it a shot. So if I were to say something like, you know, the bark fell from the trees and the sparrows that weren't making time to visit Venice Beach Boulevard where the lemonade stands fell short of their daily income and the police officers pulled people over for selling lemonade without permits. But before you knew it, you had people coming together over the wrong things and leaving together over the right things. But in time, the sun went down and the apples fell far from the tree. Super Nintendo was turning into Nintendo 64 and 64 Audio had no time left to spend on the moon descending from its crescent sage. And so you just come up with this nonsense, right? And you and every great, you know, poet has 200 bad poems in her. And so you just turn the sync valve on. You just let it come out. And then you go back to it and you're like, all right, I don't know if I got anything from that, so I'll do another set. But let's just say for the sake of this medium of podcasting, we pull something from that first set. Mm-hmm. And you circle, you're like, what did I say about people leaving for the wrong reasons? You know, like what was that? Mm-hmm. People leaving for the wrong reasons? People leaving for the wrong reasons when they expected the sun, you know, to still be out at 6:30 p.m. and it wasn't, you know, like, okay, let's extract that and let's build a story around that. So like, all right, people leaving for the wrong reasons when they expected the suns to still be out. Did they go home disappointed, falling short of what they, you know, like just you start building something more tangible out of this nonsense.
Right.
And maybe the little bit from there that was inspiring that you think you can build an exposition, you know, first verse out of isn't enough. So you do another set. And some people, I don't typically do what I did just a moment ago where I'm doing it out loud. That's really tricky because you can't really document it that much. I'll typically write it with my hand or I'll do some typing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll go back. But the more sets of that you do, I think the better off you are lyrically. And then, you know, you go back to that instrument and you just start situating it like into, you might first want to vocalize it before you even put any chords to it. You know, where is this idea of, let's say, the sun set later than we knew, or the sun went down before we knew it. Okay, so we'll take that. The sun went down before we knew it. Let's go see where that might be on the fretboard. So I'll take a root note here. The sun. Okay, so I think D might be nice. The sun set down before we knew it. Strangers became friends in the dark. We were walking with the blinders on. So on and so forth. And you start building this idea, you do another set, you're like, all right, I think I'm gonna situate it in D. That's kind of nice. What is this? Is this resonating with the affect? Or if I'm like working with like a pop star, maybe that's going to be something that's completely reinterpreted. Maybe I have to do it in a much higher register. It's a lot more like the sun set down before we knew it. So on and so forth. So
yeah,
that's kind of a process when you're running out of steam creatively by yourself or with others, you can always default to.
That's great. Because one of the things we've talked about or I've heard from others is you don't want to have a blank page for very long, right?
You want to
just like fill it with, even if it's total nonsense, because then at least you have something to work with. Like if you're doing in instrumental world, you would just literally just improvise. If you're a pianist, get it out there. See if there's four measures that sound like something that's
cool.
Decent. And that's a good idea. The stream of consciousness definitely resonates.
I think the most important thing, and I'm in my studio sweating right now, so I'm not in an optimal environment to demonstrate this as best as I wish I could, but I think that's good. I think that your listeners need to have as much non-judgment for their creative output as I just broke the ice with.
Yeah.
You can't be afraid of talking about silly things that give your insecurities away. You can't. They're there anyway. Just because they're documented doesn't say anything more or less about you. And so I think non-judgment is massive. If you can just allow yourself to not judge yourself and the silly things you're talking about, and it's important that you say it fast. I mean, again, you don't really do stream of consciousness verbally. You write it down, but it's important you write it fast, because the faster you write, the less time you have to judge it to begin with. Mm-hmm. And it takes time. The more that you do that, the more you exercise that muscle, the less pressure you'll feel. Mm. And I think it's valuable to feel that that ease and that lack of judgment in order to have a full page.
Well, and I think that's a really interesting exercise too. I feel like the creative process for a lot of people, for me included, tends to be overly analyzed, you know, extremely thought through. And you can get into this rut where, you know, you're judging the process before you even start it, right?
Yeah.
It's like you have this idea and you're like, okay, I'm going to go, you know, put this idea down, and then you go to do it, and then you start judging it in your brain beforehand, and then you just never put it down. So do you keep a journal of like just stream of consciousness thoughts? Yeah. I remember hearing this one piece of advice that was like, when you wake up in the morning, very first thing in that space in between being asleep and being awake, when you're still sort of like transitioning, that's a good place to do like two or three pages of stream of consciousness.
Yeah. I find myself, if I wake up in the middle of the night with really vivid dreams, I have a journal by my bed and I'll write things out there, because that sets up some really interesting landscapes too. Kind of visiting that realm of your subconscious, and that kind of does the job of, you going out on the subway and seeing a stranger. It kind of does the job for you. And I've heard great things about that exercise of doing it first thing in the morning, but I think that it being too rule-based gets in the way of that non-judgment feature. Because as soon as you don't do the rule-oriented method, you're going to start judging yourself from the get-go and feel like your creative output, however it is going to be, it's going to have its shortcomings because you didn't do it the way you were supposed to.
Yeah.
So I don't tend to do something too ritualistically, even down to songwriting. I love to create. But that can be in a variety of mediums within music. You know, it can be 90-second songs I put out on my social media channels, or just, this is how you, I found myself, when you're on tour, you can advertise yourself on tour really easily, but when you're working on records, it's really hard because you can't leak what you're working on. And so I realized, and I had just had such a fun beginning of the year working on a lot of projects from home, and I wanted to keep doing that. I wanted to emphasize more time in the studio than on the road. So I thought, I'll start a project where I just grab an instrument, like I said earlier in the podcast, and just play an idea, record it with my iPhone in real time, add something else to it. It'll be 90 seconds or so. And I have found so much joy in that process. And it's also alleviated this pressure to keep writing material. So in the more traditional lyrical American songbook way.
Yeah, it sounds like it's sort of like structuring your life around free creative expression rather than putting the expectation on yourself of, I need to do this. It actually kind of harkens back to what Tetra was talking about in his episode, which is you should set up the mechanisms in your life so that creativity is easy, that it's not a big lift, that you don't have to, you know, either put pressure on yourself or do all of these things to be creative.
It all flows into the same river too. I think that ease comes with thinking that it doesn't matter specifically how this creative output is purposed.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know how it'll end up being purposed. Maybe this is the thing that you come into that songwriting session with as an alternative for your artist, in the same way a composer has this little idea that came to them in the middle of the night with no particular commission or aim, but maybe it's something that Christopher Nolan's really going to be fascinated by, even though it has nothing to do with his script, you know?
Right.
So I do think that the one thing I will say about structure, to reinforce your point, is that ease is great. I don't think any creative is happy when their creative flow gets compromised by technical things falling short. So it's funny because we're thinking about building a bigger studio. My wife, Molly, has one on the other end of the house, and I have this tiny one on this end of the house. We're thinking of building a big one, but a part of me feels like if I actually have to like walk to get an instrument, that might slow down the ease of everything.
Yeah.
But it would invite more collaboration and having a bigger space. So I'm figuring that out. But I think finding a way to not overwhelm yourself is really great. Having ease as you work through the creative process is key. Yeah. And not having too much of an aim. And again, I'm just another dude with his own set of opinions. I'm not here to like preach anything that will work for everybody else. It's just worked all right for me the last 20 some odd years I've been pursuing it.
That's actually good advice too. It should come, if it's coming easy, it tends to just be better. Meaning there's this idea you've heard of like try hard. And I'm sure we've all done this where we like are working really, really hard on like 16 bars of music or something.
Yeah.
And we're trying to make it be something just like, and cause, but the foundation is wrong. You know, it's really, we should just select all, delete.
And
just try something that comes a little bit more naturally and build on that.
That's the time where I would say you take that piece that you've been working really hard on and kind of banging your head against the wall to make it work, and you put it in your back pocket, and then you move on to something else, and you carry that around with you for however long it takes.
Yeah.
Maybe you never touch it again, or maybe, you know, at some point months or years down the road, you're like, oh yeah, there's that, you know, I'll go through my voice notes every 2 or 3 months, and I've got voice notes all the way back to like 2016.
Oh, wow.
And I'll just start listening. I have them all organized. I went through like a few months ago and organized them into like song ideas or whatever. And I'll just start listening and I'll be like, holy shit, I completely forgot about that idea. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
You know, maybe I'll pull that out and give it another go.
No, absolutely. I think if you're only making it through 3/4 of that those 16 bars and you're like, oh man, it's got to be perfect because these first 12 are precious.
Mm-hmm.
You can listen to yourself. And you, as you said, Chris, you can carry that in your back pocket. Or if you're finding yourself scrolling through voice notes from nearly a decade ago, first of all, I want to say it again, when you go back to it, do not judge yourself.
Yeah.
I think that there's a really important correlation between how much we judge other creatives and how much we judge ourselves. And the more we judge other creatives, I tend to think we are less prolific. Mm-hmm. Because we know the depths at which people can criticize our work because of how much we're capable of criticizing others' work. So when I started criticizing people's work much less, when I stopped, it's just such low hanging fruit to talk about with another person, something you hate, you guys mutually don't like and think is garbage. And that to me, I think is toxic to you as a creative. So if you can go back to those voice notes without judgment, there's gold in there. You're telling me there's pre-existing data, clay that is mine, as far as you know, like that you could just get to apply to this next thing. I'm telling you, last night around like midnight, I was just, I had this cool guitar thing on this rubber bridge, you know, and it's great. You know, like have instruments that inspire you, find things that inspire you. I've been really into this, using this meditation bowl lately. I can't get enough of this sound. I think it's E flat, but like anytime it fits anything, I'm just like, I'm throwing it in the mix. It just inspires me. And
everything's an E flat then. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Everything's an E flat. So I'll send you guys some samples of that application. It's pretty cool. But that goes to say like, find things that inspire you. And then once you're inspired, go back to something that once inspired you that you left incomplete. And maybe those weeks, months, years, decades in time, as they've passed, you've written something that really fulfills you much more than it would have if you pushed through it. Because again, the reason we're saying, hey, don't be precious with things, we're not saying don't be precious with things and then release, release, release. We're saying, like, just as a creative exercise, again, every great poet has 200 bad poems in them. Mm-hmm. Another thing I will say on the note, just as I bring up poetry, I love this poet, Billy Collins. He put it this way once. When he's writing a poem, he looks at Wizard of Oz as a really great reference point. Don't start with the flying monkeys. Don't start with the flying monkeys. Start in Kansas. Mm-hmm. Flatlands, natural disaster, something that we can all grasp. She wakes up with golden roads and all these, like, these anthropomorphic figures. And then they walk through this forest and they experience all these wild things, these surreal settings. And then the flying monkeys come. I think with lyrics, I do really like, in the storytelling side of things, starting with things that are much more down to earth before we get too heady. I used mm-hmm. to not be that way because, of course, you know, I didn't know what I was doing when I was a kid. But I think that's why starting with a glass on the table has value to it.
Right.
Because before you know it, you can then be referencing angels or something like that.
That makes sense. Yeah. Start somewhere tangible.
Yeah.
That the listener can sort of grasp onto and be like, oh, I know what that's about.
Totally. I think so. I think being able to fit yourself in there, because my favorite band is Radiohead. You know, I love things that, you know, Bon Iver, I love lyrics that leave you wondering. But even then, you know, I think of like Tom York's lyric, like, when a leak becomes a lake, you know, it's like, that's even referencing something that's just, as a homeowner, something I think about, and somebody who loves nature, I think about, like, don't leave your audience behind, like leave room for them to find themselves in there. Lately, there's been this conversation about Rick Rubin's take versus Jacob Collier's take on songwriting. Mm. And Rick Rubin's take is something to the effect, and I could be paraphrasing this horribly, but is, consider your audience last. And then Jacob Collier's take is, no, I actually think it's a great exercise to consider your audience first. And I've had this conversation come up with a lot of times with friends and colleagues about, what do you think is best? Jacob Collier is a prodigy. He's one of the most brilliant, technical, visceral musicians that's working right now. And then on the other side, you have someone like Rick Rubin, and these memes have gone wild where he just says out loud, he goes, I have no musical, no technical ability. Yeah. I don't know what I'm doing with a soundboard. I think in those instances, both are right.
Yeah.
If you're Jacob and you could do anything and everything, well, it's quite possible that if you're only thinking about yourself, the end result could be pretty masturbatory.
Sure.
But if you're Rick Rubin and you have limited resources and your goal is to be as present with the collaborators in your room that presumably also have finite resources creatively, then let's just think about this moment. Let's not think about the audience, because we might, you know, we might shape this into something we think they want. And so that just goes to say, on the spectrum of songwriting, everybody is clearly coming into a room with different offerings. Mm-hmm. And that's why I go back again and again to non-judgment and being prolific. Exercising that muscle is great. You know, going for a creative walk every day, it's not just good in the short term. It's massively beneficial in the long term.
When there's a big piece of that example that you gave too, with Rick Rubin and
Jacob
Collier. Forgot his first name. It's like understanding yourself, you know what I mean? And building the mechanisms or yeah. pieces into it from a place of understanding yourself, which is kind of what songwriting is, right? It's like, songwriting is to a degree an exploration of self. And then when you sort of extrapolate it into an example like that one, it's like, well, what are you coming in with? You know, where are you coming from? Where are you trying to go? What's your goal here? It's Jacob Collier understanding that if he focuses on the audience first, it will keep his music from being too masturbatory, because he is working with an entirely different tool set than Rick Rubin. Whereas Rick Rubin's mystical power is essentially to be in that present moment. And it's essentially to like draw that out of the artists that he's working with, mm-hmm. you know?
I really connect to that way of looking at it, man. Yeah. Yeah. Self-elucidation. That's just good work that doesn't seem relevant to being a songwriter, but I think it's really helpful. Yeah. And that's why I guess that all the, sort of adjacent things like journaling and meditation and, you know, intentional, I don't want to say isolation, but solitude, mm-hmm. to spend that time with yourself in order to get an idea of who you are, is really, really beneficial in the songwriting community.
Yeah. And that self-awareness feeds the songwriting feeds the self-awareness, and it's sort of this like holistic symbiotic thing, right?
Yeah. Yeah, dude. I mean, like anything else, I'm getting in my own head right now about like how silly that stream of consciousness exercise that we did in real time was. Like, oh my goodness.
I thought it was awesome.
maybe we'll do this more and I'll get better at it. But goodness, like the grace that you have to give yourself in order to become so confident and calm in things. It's like, it's such a superpower.
Yeah.
If you're willing to risk embarrassing yourself creatively in order to work those muscles, you have to be willing to take chances that are coming from a real sincere place that don't get it. You know, you want to have self-awareness, but you also don't want to you don't want to keep yourself in a box. You don't want to feel so self-critical. And again, I think there's an important correlation between criticizing others and criticizing yourself. So the less you do it to others, the less you'll do it to yourself. But those sorts of things, I think I just think it's important to practice exercising those muscles. If not to eventually be like, okay, so do less next time. Don't right. insert yourself in this way. You know, you've learned from that. Yeah, man, not to go off the topic of songwriting, but I think in our industry, it's a fine line of playing by the rules, but as creatives, that's almost counterintuitive at times.
Yeah, it's kind of antithetical to who we are.
Yeah. Well, you said it before when you said, I need someone who can play the mandolin. And you're like, yes, I play the mandolin.
Right.
I mean, that's, but it puts yourself in this situation where you kind of have imposter syndrome. But I think that like, this is good advice, I think for younger people who might be just out of college or they're in their 20s, it's like, just, you know, you don't know who you are yet, you know, just go for it. If you get an opportunity, just get ready to fail, you know, just
Put
yourself in an uncomfortable situation. And if you feel like an imposter, that's probably a good thing.
I think so too. I think so too. I fail forward, wrong and strong. Yeah. I've heard before.
Yeah.
But, and at that age, I think that's a good point, Mike, like really bringing it to younger folks at that age, especially, you know, whether it's like late teens, early mid 20s, mm-hmm. those are great periods of time in your life to not get sleep because you're learning the new instrument to play on that, on just those 2 out of 8 songs in that set that's going to get you on your first world tour and introduce you to members of the band you're opening for, who may one day ask you to then play keyboards or mandolin or these auxiliary instruments. And before you know it, you're silly to call yourself an imposter because you've been doing this on the road for 6 months or a year and you have a documented resume. Because you said yes, you didn't put yourself in too narrow of a box.
Exactly.
And you were willing to potentially fail. Just remember, if you say yes, you have to put in that stupid amount of work.
Yeah.
So at least you know you did give it your best.
Yeah. And when you're young, your brain still works, you know?
Yeah.
There's a little bit more neural plasticity. When you're 43 like me, it takes a lot longer. Like I challenged myself to learn how to solve a Rubik's Cube last year. And
cool.
It took me forever because it's like the brain is trying to learn something new. And it's just like, man, if I was 23, I would have nailed this much faster.
Yeah. But yeah, I want to adopt that.
It's a good thing to do when you're young.
Do you guys feel, not to be the one asking questions, but going, you mentioned neuroplasticity, and do you guys feel like there are values to, or there is a value to journaling as well, like in the composer world? The reason I bring that up is because I know there's this great exercise that when you go through you know, difficult times ranging from like, oh, this was hard to this was extremely traumatic and you're suffering through PTSD. There are exercises via journaling where you write for anywhere from 15 to 30 minutes straight about the facts of the hardest time of your life, mm-hmm. how you felt about it, how you feel about it now. And you do that 15 to 30 minutes straight. You do that 4 consecutive days in a row. And it has, there's been a lot of, it's done things to like relieve people of fibromyalgia, of IBS, and it's helped a tremendous amount of people through PTSD. And as I was navigating some really scary health diagnoses last year, I was diagnosed with a heart arrhythmia that required 2 pretty intense procedures done on my heart. It was really beneficial for me to go through this journaling process, and very difficult. But when we talk about knowing yourself in order to be a better songwriter, I feel like I've gotten to face myself with all the tears and the unsettling feelings that come alongside it. And I feel more connected to myself now than I've ever been as a result of that process. Is there an application for that as a composer, especially when it's not so deadline-based?
I would say there's an application for it as a human being, for sure. Mm-hmm. I think Andrew Huberman, I don't know if you follow his podcast.
That's the one I'm referencing.
Yeah, I think that's the episode. As a composer, because composers tend to be instrumentalists, I think it's good to just let yourself, you know, hit the record button and just noodle, you know, and mm-hmm. just write stuff and try to do it every day. As for me, I mean, I try to go for walks every day and I leave long voice memos, you know, just what's going on in my life. Sometimes they're prayerful. Sometimes it's just a meditative thing. Sometimes it's just like, hey, this is what's going on. This is what I'm struggling with, or this is a success we've had today, or this is what I'm grateful for. I try to do that every day. First, you got to focus on who you are as a human. And then I think it comes out in your creative work.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. On that note, I think inherently any kind of creative work does involve some kind of self-awareness. And in the context of film composing, it's like, what are you doing? What's your job there? Your job there is to support the story and the emotional aspects of that story. The more in touch you are with your emotions, the more in touch you can be with what the emotional aspect of this part of the story is. You know, because you are essentially, really with any kind of music or any kind of art, at least the way I view it is, you are essentially sort of like synthesizing emotion into something that's a little bit more tangible, whether it's visual art or sonic landscapes or things like that. You're trying to create a feeling and an emotion in the person who is consuming that art. So in order to do that, whether you're writing your own music or, you know, supporting somebody else's vision, any kind of exercise, whether it's journaling or speaking into, you know, a journal app or something like that, any kind of self-exploration is going to help you be a little bit more honest internally with what's going on with your emotions. And that will, like you said, Mike, inherently, whether directly or indirectly, affect your creative output.
Yeah. I think when composers get older, it's kind of like, it's like a fine wine. Hopefully it gets better with time. I know John Williams is obviously my hero. Mm-hmm. And one of the first films he did, he was 45. So it gives us hope. And it was Jaws, I believe, 1976, 77. You know, it's just such a brilliant score, the detail, you know, the craftsmanship. Mm-hmm. But it's almost like for him, like all of the stuff that we struggle with, like, all right, what's the range of the flute? None of that stuff matters to someone like him at that age.
Right.
You know, and it just, all the details come secondary, where he can just hear it in his mind and be able to just execute on it. And I think that just comes with the challenges and successes of life. And I'm sure there's connection. Man. I mean, this is a great conversation because I never think about this stuff. So,
Well, yeah, I know. And you bring up John Williams. We've been going to the Hollywood Bowl just about every year, you know, for the last 15 years to see his nights. And I am truly, I don't think I've ever seen a crowd of 17,000 people like that go so hard for like a four encore night with
them. Oh yeah.
We just rage. And it says so much about wanting to know the story of the storyteller.
Yeah.
And he's a composer, mm-hmm. you know, he's also the most like decorated Academy Award winner. But like, I think that's a really good point, Chris, is being willing to place some emphasis on who you are when you're telling any story in any medium, because whether you want it to or not, it will be filtered through you.
Absolutely.
And so I think that there is, I don't want to be too hippy dippy, as my beloved mother-in-law might say, shout out Frankfort, Kentucky. But that goes to say, I do think that there is value in self-elucidation as a practice, you know, whether it's journaling, or I also connect with what you were talking about, Mike, just going on those walks with the voice memo and reflecting, that solitude, that reflection. I think it kind of clears things out as you go into a session. You're much more of an open vehicle. You can default to your bag of tricks. Like, that's all in your muscles and your instincts, but you're not muddying up areas where you can more clearly receive unforeseen inspiration. You're not muddying up those areas. You're open to it. And then you have the technical skill to just roll with it. And I think that's absolutely applicable to modern day songwriting. You know, yeah. I will give shout outs to a couple songwriters who I think are just carrying that torch so unbelievably well right now. In fact, I'll just keep it to one to not take up too much of your guys' time, but I can't get enough of Madison Cunningham right now. This woman is an extraordinary player, writer, lyricist, insane singer. And if people could just model that, be inspired by what she's doing, I'm telling you, start with any song, any record. But Madison Cunningham, man, one of the most inspiring songwriters I have seen in a very, very long time.
I'll have to check her out. I haven't heard of her.
Yeah. Yeah. Can't say enough about her. So good.
Yes. I think my daughter is into her. I have a 16-year-old daughter.
Yeah. Madison Cunningham. Yeah. That pumps me up. Okay. That if she's like excited, if a 16-year-old person is excited about Maddie Cunningham, then I'm stoked about Gen Z. That's good news. That's good news.
Yeah. So in talking about exploring yourself in the vulnerability, taking that sort of deep dive, it's one thing to do that on your own. It's another thing to do it in the context of a band, right? Taking that dive into yourself, all of you kind of doing it together, and expressing or exposing that type of vulnerability to other people. So what would you say, as somebody who's played in a lot of bands, written a lot of music with bands, and written a lot of music on your own, what is the difference between the two experiences? And do you prefer one over the other?
I don't know. I'll try to do a good job answering that question, because it sounds like there's a lot of value to that question. I will be honest with you. It's going through a filter of something I've been struggling with recently, and it is the massive decline in bands.
Yeah, same.
It's so much more affordable to be an artist and make as much music as you can left to your own devices. And then if you blow up and get label touring support, you can put a band around you. And we're seeing that as a result of how difficult it is to make a living as a band. This may be dating me, but there just aren't a lot of bands that are able to do that.
Yeah.
Even as I shout out Madison Cunningham, is like, I love what she does as a writer. I love her with her band. You know, I don't know to what extent they're equity members as much as they're hired guns who put their heart into the music they equally believe in as she does. But, you know, going back to being a kid who started learning about songwriting through very basic Open the Eyes of My Heart, Lord songs, and then getting thrown into a world with people whose influences, like my now wife's, were like Alan Parsons Project and Toto and Queen. And then somebody else, like my beloved friend and drummer, Mike Musselman, who's all about like the Death Grips and Frank Zappa. Mm-hmm. And then someone else like Nick Chamion on bass, who was all about classic rock and funk. It goes back to being like, okay, if I can clearly admit to who I am relative to who these people are as far as creative influence is concerned, I'm going to realize that I have all these spots in my self, I guess, just to learn from these people. And man, I think when you're collaborating with people, there's a whole argument to be made about band leaders and this and that. But in my experience with original projects, I have been in bands with people who are not on the same creative page as me inherently, but we trust fall when we're in the rehearsal space. We trust fall on one another to say, maybe your way is best. What does it look like when I imitate it? And I think that may be one of the reasons, you know, Chris, you were a fan of my bands coming up because it ended up being kind of progressive sounding. And at the heart of it was still a guy who liked to write simple acoustic songs, but is now playing in like 7/8 time and experimenting with pedals and letting the drummer just go haywire, you know? So I think that if you're going to pursue a band creatively, which is something I would love to do just for the fun of it again, surround yourself with people you trust. And if you trust them enough, don't feel like you have to cling to who you are, because that gets in the way of who you might be as a result of their creative influence.
Yeah. Yeah. There's, you know, I've kind of been struggling with the same thing internally, right? The lack of bands, the sort of prevalence of a more isolated musical creative experience. But there's something that you just can't supplement for in the idea of collaborating with other people on the creative front. It's one thing to collaborate with other people if you have a song and you're bringing them in and you're saying, hey, you know, you can add to this or pepper this in here.
Right.
But to write a song from scratch with other people and do exactly what you said, which is trust fall sort of into this experience together. You know, one of the things that I that has echoed in my head for a couple of years now is like, I alone am only as good as my own limitations.
Yeah.
Right. I have limitations, as everybody does, when it comes to skill or the way that I think about music or the way that I approach creativity. But when you put yourself into a room with three or four or five other people and you're all creating together, you're going to sort of inherently, if you have that trust open, start to expand each other's limitations,
you know,
because now you're working with someone who approaches music from a completely different perspective. And it's something that maybe you never thought you would ever like, but then you try it on and you're like, oh, actually this feels good. You know, this perspective feels good to wear. This approach is actually kind of nice. And even if your goal is not to have a successful music career as a band, even if you are a more inherently individual creator, playing in a band is only going to make you better as a creator and vice versa.
I think that what ends up happening when you're trying to make it more equitable for everybody is that the emphasis gets put on the instrumentation and having some. So if I want the drummer and the bassist and the violinist or, you know, whatever it may be, if I want the musicians in the band to feel as if they have equal stake in this eventual end product, this creative end product, then we're going to put emphasis on the instrumentation and we're going to focus on making something unique that leans into. I remember when I had this one song called Cusp and like the lyrics were definitely the last thing that we cared about. But like the riff was something like this. It was 3/4. And just like, hey, that's weird and cool. And can we all come together to make something like, let's get some counter melodies in there on the strings and let's have the drums like really groove. But there, I remember hearing this back in the day and as a millennial, it's like we call it the Incubus effect. When you're watching Incubus play live, pick any band member. You could just focus on them equally as much as Brandon Boyd or anybody else.
Yeah.
And so when I'm writing in a band, and if I were to write again now, I would take that approach that I hear with Radiohead or their newer trio, The Smile, and I would write something really interesting musically, and then I would write vocals to fit that interesting idea first. I think that's an amazing exercise as a lyricist, as a vocalist, to fit into pre-existing instrumentation. I think that's more fun for everybody. I think it gives more equity, like authentic equity, to the musicians in the band who perhaps aren't writing lyrical content or singing. And it's how I like to do it. And it's really exciting. And I think that left to my own devices, I can still write things that way. Like if you check out an EP I put out in 2021, I have a song on there called Trigger Finger. And that was me left to my own devices as best as I could, doing something harkening back to the era of me being in bands and writing weird time signatures with the instrumentation in the forefront, you know, and then fitting crazy lyrical content into it after the fact.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's funny you when you were walking us through your process of the stream of consciousness writing and then starting with the lyrics and then finding a vocal melody and then fitting music to that.
Yeah, chord progression to fit into the melody. Yeah,
the complete opposite of the way that I do it. It's always music first for me.
That's dope.
But hey, I know we set aside an hour and a half, and I don't want to keep you any longer than the time that we've put aside, because I know we're all busy people and we have things to do. So just one last question from me is, like, if any of the listeners are curious about songwriting or just sort of starting to experiment with songwriting, what is a piece of advice that you would sort of impart to them, you know, as they start to embark on their journey into songwriting?
Embrace the weird. I would say embrace the weird. A lot of great songwriters know you only really need, like, to know how to play three chords to write 3,000 songs. Don't worry about fitting in to, like, your local songwriter scene. If there's a way that you feel, back to Chris's point earlier, that writing a song is a means for getting closer to figuring out who you are, it's a means for expressing your identity more and more with every tune, then don't be afraid of doing things outside of the norm as a writer. And as you do it, I think the only way, and this is taking a tip from Ira Glass, the only way that your artistic output will eventually be on the same level as your taste is by going through a volume of work. Mm-hmm. So don't be too precious about things. As a teacher, because I still work with music education so much, when we lean into the creative, it's the perfectionist who are the ones who struggle to put out the most. And as I've demonstrated in this podcast, trying to do stream of consciousness for the first time, don't worry about it being perfect. Don't, before you put it out there, it's an important muscle to exercise. I'll say it a third time. Every great poet has 200 bad poems in her. That might also be from Billy Collins, but I think it's critical that you embrace the weird, do it with non-judgment. And yeah, I think more is more. The more you write, the better. And then over time, you know, if you're able to really turn this into something that you're able to do on a consistent basis, refinement is great. Refinement's there, and you'll find it in a variety of ways. It may come to you in one sitting. It really might. Some amazing songs have. That's why people can work in half-day sessions and turn out a massive pop song. Mm-hmm. But it also may be a failed day to you until a few years later you pick up that three quarters of stuff you liked and you complete it, and it's a much more meaningful thing than it would have been if you pushed through it then. So I think that's my advice.
Awesome, man. What are you working on that you're excited about? Where can people keep up with you?
You know, like I said, and I think that it's cool to talk about this too, because I have found a lot of benefit from people being transparent with the stuff they're going through. So last year, you know, my life turned upside down when I was diagnosed with atrial fibrillation and atrial flutter and atrial tachycardia. And I wasn't able to tour. So I spent a lot of time, as I was trying to figure out the best way to treat what I was going through, writing. And so whether I want it to be or not, it's turned out to be a bit of a concept record going through those motions of getting better. And I'm also very happy to say I'm doing a lot better. I was able to get a procedure done in December that seems to be keeping me in really great shape. I'm coming up on 4 months without any episodes. And
dude, that's amazing.
Yeah. I couldn't be happier. So, but it was a very, very, very dark period. And thank God I had access to these creative outlets. So I'm working on finishing up that that collection of songs. And so I'm not sure when that'll come out. Because I'm also playing on other people's records and I'm teaching a bunch of people and I'm doing some composing for the first time now, which is really exciting. But I think that one thing I'm excited to point to, considering what the majority of what we've been talking about today is songwriting, is this eventual record that I'll be releasing before the end of the year. And in the meantime, you can check out my existing tunes just at my name, Scott Goldbaum, all my socials on all the DSPs. And if you like some of the things we were talking about and you want to hear them in the context of the bands that Chris and I were referencing, you could check out bands of mine like Wise Cub, Forebear, and even you could probably find the band that I was in when Chris and I met when we were like teenagers called The Harm. The Harm Music on Bandcamp probably has a bunch of our stuff there. So if you want to dive into and to hear me at my angstiest, feel free to do a deep dive there.
And I'll attest, it's worth it. Forebear was my absolute favorite Los Angeles local band while you guys were together. And so was The Harm, for that matter.
Thanks, Homie. Yeah. Well, it's there's been some talk about us in our older age, be it remotely or coming together at our boy, Matt Tuggle. Matt Tuggle was a founding member of The Harm when we were kids, and he's gone on to become a massive engineer working with John Mayer and Greg Kurstin. And he's got a home studio now. So we may be revisiting that and making a record, you know, goodness, 15 years later, 20 years later.
Dude, I can't wait. That's going to be awesome.
Thank you guys so much for having me on, by the way. I really love what you guys have been doing, listening to the previous podcast. And getting to be a part of it was such a delight.
Dude, thank you for being here. Thanks for sharing your thoughts on songwriting. This is actually a really great, great conversation.
Yeah, this was great, man. Scott. Great to meet you.
You guys as well. Be well, dudes. Thanks so much.
Thank you all for listening. And a special thanks to Scott for sharing his songwriting thoughts, tips, and tricks. And I highly recommend that you go check out his music. It really is incredibly beautifully crafted. Just go to his website, scottgoldbaum.com, or check out the show notes where we've included all of the links. Once again, if you like this conversation and you want to hear more like it, don't forget to rate and review the podcast. We really love being able to share these conversations with music creators like you, and every bit of feedback that we get helps us to continue doing that. You can find us on Instagram at Musio and on YouTube at Musio.official. And if you're a music creator and you're looking for high-quality virtual instruments, just head over to Musio.com to get literally thousands of them, completely free for 30 days. Thank you again for listening. We really hope that this conversation was as valuable for you as it was for us. Now get out there and write some songs, or do some stream of consciousness journaling. And we'll catch you on the next one.